Welcome to Money for the Restless Plus. This is Dick Pannon, episode 169 on the debt ceiling. It is Friday afternoon, November 18th. Eclipse weekend. Eclipse is on Monday, and we're getting all ready. It's coming right over Idaho. Complete total eclipse. Should be a great experience. Maybe I'll podcast about it. I don't know. But today's episode, I want to start out. We're going to talk a little bit about trust, money, and trust. The dollar and Bitcoin. Have a question on self-directed IRAs that I'm going to answer. Question on somebody that's approaching retirement is considering reallocating, is concerned about the tax consequences. So we will also talk about that. But in the member forums, I believe it was Keith posted a comment on the episode and mentioned just the risk of the investment community, the world, losing faith in the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. In other words, and that could lead to a spike in interest rates. We could also have a situation where our government leaders just create too much money, and that leads to inflation. And it brings back a very, very important point. We can talk about the national debt. We can look at the numbers. We can understand how the theory works, how money is just digits. But it all comes down to trust. And if the general public no longer has confidence in the dollar could weaken. If they no longer have confidence in government debt, for whatever reason, that potentially, I mean, the Federal Reserve can always step in and monetize it in extreme situation. But ultimately, any asset class depends on trust. That's why Bitcoin is such a fascinating asset class, because it's just digits. Well, here's Peter Schiff. He is a CEO and global chief strategist at a broker-dealer in Westport, Connecticut, called Euro Pacific Capital. He was recently interviewed, I think it was the publication CoinDesk. He says, in regards to Bitcoin, is that, well, first off, he likens it to digital fool's gold and compared it to the infamous bubble in Beanie Babies. Now, Beanie Babies were these little stuffed animal things that got very, very popular. I think there's a little bit of difference because the Beanie Baby supply was unlimited. The Bitcoin supply is not. There's a set amount, but it still comes down to trust. Now, he brings up some other good points. Well, in his opinion, money must be a commodity. In other words, he doesn't believe in fiat currency. He believes money should be backed by something of value, in this case, gold. And there was a couple other quotes that he said. So, well, here's what the article says. According to Schiff, government-issued money works because there are other valuable things people can do with money. All of the following, for example, are true of fiat currency. You can pay taxes using fiat currency. You can buy insurance denominated in dollars, and you can buy bonds denominated in dollars, which will pay you interest in dollars. Now, that's true, and that's what gives fiat currency legitimacy. You can't do any of those things with gold or with Bitcoin. You cannot pay your taxes in gold, cannot do so in Bitcoin, cannot do the same. You can't buy insurance with gold or Bitcoin, and you can't buy bonds with gold. You have to always convert them to the account value, the currency of record in a given country, and that's just the nature of it. So is Bitcoin in a bubble? No idea, because it's a speculative asset. The sign of the return, its value, is completely dependent on the amount of trust people have in it. Since I did the Bitcoin episode and bought some more Bitcoin, it's up 40%. I would love Bitcoin to be cut in half so I can buy some more. But I'm not investing in Bitcoin as if I don't think it's like gold. I think it has some interesting characteristics, but it is a speculation. For equal reason, I have not gone out and bought 20-year or 30-year treasury bonds because I'm not absolutely certain the trust will remain in the dollar long-term and in U.S. treasury bonds. And so there's a risk of an interest rate spike, not predicting it, but it's just one of those things that I don't want to. I have enough dollar exposure in terms of other assets not to try to go out and buy a very, very long-term bond, which I believe if markets sold off, rates would fall and they would do very, very well. But there are some other risks to it. So that's just a few thoughts on fiat currency and some of those issues. So I have a question from a member who is interested in investing more in Peer Street. Peer Street is a crowdfunding platform. You are investing in debt that, or essentially you're lending on real estate, houses principally, some offices, mostly houses, mostly to individuals who are flipping those houses and trying to make a profit. And the average yield's about 7%. It's secured by real estate. Typically, the borrower is putting some equity down. Your typical deal might have 75% debt to equity value. So this member has $3 million almost entirely in Vanguard tax-deferred accounts, 401k, and an individual retirement account. He still has exposure to the Vanguard High Yield Corporate Bond Fund. This was a fund that was part of the model portfolios that we exited earlier this year, just because yields got so low. So he's looking at potentially allocating that Vanguard high yield bond exposure to Peer Street. And he saw that Peer Street offers an individual retirement account and wanted to know sort of how does that work? How does it work? And is it safe? Are there potential issues in doing a self-directed individual retirement account? And in terms of how would he get this money invested? So Peer Street has partnered with a firm called Self-Directed IRA Services. It's a division of Horizon Bank. So that's the custodian that interacts and does the tax work and sends out the statements. And so there are other self-directed custodians out there for individual retirement accounts. And what these custodians allow you to do is to buy non-publicly traded assets. So you can hold precious metals, you can own private real estate, or other things in these asset, or essentially in these custody accounts. Now, Self-Directed IRA Services has been around since 2008. I do not have a very good handle on the self-directed IRA market in terms of the brokers that are out there, but I do have confidence in Peer Street that they did some due diligence and selected a firm that's been doing it for some time. There are some fees, though. I believe that Peer Street will reimburse some initial fees, but there's an annual fee for their crowdfunding schedule because they have a different schedule if you're holding different assets. But if your IRA is invested in a crowdfunding platform such as Peer Street, the annual fee is $100. Per year, plus $50 for each crowdfunding platform. So if you were only using Peer Street, it'd be $150 a year, plus $50 if you, anytime you send new money to self-directed IRA services or to Peer Street through the IRA, $25 for wires. So you just kind of have to figure out there's going to be some fees there. But other than that, I would be comfortable investing in a real estate, something like Peer Street through a self-directed individual retirement account. I don't think there's any huge risk in doing so. In terms of how I would go about it, I would average in, which is actually your only choice. But first, let's get back to high-yield bonds. So the absolute yield on high-yield bonds right now is about 5.8%. That's as of yesterday. And so there's going to be defaults at some point over the next decade in non-investment grade bonds. There's defaults every year. If we assume about a 4% default rate, a 40% recovery, that means your return, your expected return, you take that yield minus about 2.4%, which would be 40% times 4% default rate. So your overall return, expected return for non-investment grade bonds over the next decade is 3.4%. Contrast that with Peer Street. The average loan in my portfolio on Peer Street, I have about 75 different loans, is 7 to 7.5%. Typically, I only lend for 12 months. I make sure that the investors have put some skin in the game, that they actually put in a meaningful amount of equity. Average loan to equity value is about 70 to 75%. And so potentially there'll be some defaults on these loans. I'm sure there will be. But my hope is there's enough equity cushion that if the property has to be resold, that I'll get my money back. About 18% of the loans in my Pier Street portfolio, the way that that works is Pier Street will, they make comments. So if somebody's missed a payment and they're trying to track it down, they'll make a comment. If they haven't paid off the loan entirely, they're trying an extension or any type of event related to a loan, not a default, but just something in the ongoing processing that they want to make the lenders aware of, or investors like me, about 18% of those loans have some type of comment. So that kind of gives you an idea. I've not had any defaults, but there are problems that can arise. Now, as I look out over the next few years, I believe that I'll earn a higher return with Pier Street than I would with non-investment grade bonds, just because the yield is higher and the potential for default risk or higher default risk with non-investment grade bonds. So as an investor, if you would put in 4% of $3 million, that's $120,000. So typically, you would want to invest $1,000 to $2,000 per loan. That'll give you 60 to 100 loans. Generally, I do the automated investing. So I turn on automated investing. I put my criteria that I don't want to lend for longer than 1 year, just as an additional margin of safety. I want a minimum of 75% debt to equity. And then they start coming up with loans. Now, if you have a lot of cash, they'll probably come up with 2 to 3 per day. I'll review them to see if they have the individual properties. I might pull it up on Zillow, but I'll look to see just how much money they've put in, what's the credit score, try to make sure I get some geographic diversification. And then if I'm fine with it, I let it go. I don't have to do anything. If I'm concerned, then I hit cancel. So it'll take you time to get a portfolio to work. You could do a bigger percent in each loan of your portfolio, but that's kind of how I've done it. And it took me a couple months to average in to get most of that money invested that I have invested. So that's how I would do it and kind of give you a perspective. But doing it through an individual retirement account, I'm perfectly fine with that. Next question is from a member who has $2.4 million in assets, about $1.4 million with Merrill Lynch in a individual retirement account. That's 60% stocks, 40% bonds. He has another million in Vanguard, 90% stocks, 10% bonds. He says, I feel like I need to start reducing potential volatility at some point. But how do I figure out when and how? I'm going to need to stop contributing in about 2 years, but we'll have income to live on for 6 years beyond that before tapping investments. I don't want to just sell equity and buy bonds due to the capital gains tax. Any general strategy and timing you would recommend or consider? Well, first off, given that allocation split between the two, you're about 72.5% stocks, 28.5% bonds, you could lower your stock exposure without any capital gains issue by reducing your allocation to equity in the Merrill Lynch account. I don't know what options are available. It sounds like that was a 401k, but that's a simple way to do it, not have to worry about taxes. But here's the thing on capital gains tax with the taxable account. Module 6, Lesson 5 on Money for the Rest of Us has a lesson and a spreadsheet on how to decide whether to sell a taxable asset. And the simple assumption there is you can look at, sell an asset, you look at the cost basis, you now have an after-tax dollar amount that you're now investing in a new asset. And if that new asset has a higher expected return than the old asset, then eventually there'll be a break-even year where you'll have been better off selling the old asset, taking the tax hit, and investing the new asset. But if you're overweight equity and you want to reduce your exposure to stocks and put it in bonds or something else, then there isn't any break-even year because the new asset will more than likely have a lower expected return than the old asset. And so the only reason to sell is exactly what he says. You're trying to reduce volatility. And why reduce volatility? What is the whole exercise here? Well, we don't want to be in a situation as you enter retirement that you're protecting against, not even you're protecting against volatility, you're protecting against a major sell-off in the stock market. And so the question is, how, if you continue 75, 72% stocks, and stocks sold off 40% or 50% during a recession, how would that impact your retirement plans and your spending? Because if, I don't know what your basis is in your stock, but if you sell in your taxable account a stock that, let's say, whatever, it's just completely taxable, so your basis is zero, that means you immediately take a 20% hit on those assets and then invest them or redeploy them in a different asset category. Presumably, you have a higher basis, so it's not going to be exactly a 20% hit, but that's what you're weighing against. A 15 to 20% hit now versus the potential impact of a 40 to 50% decline on those same assets. And there's just not a right answer there. You want to potentially take the capital gains hit in a period. Maybe you have some offsetting losses somewhere to reduce it, or your overall taxable income is lower in 1 year. But ultimately, taxes are going to be paid if you want to reduce volatility. Now, a couple other things you consider is you don't necessarily have to go into bonds. You could go into assets as you take your 20% hit. And perhaps there is an asset that has a higher return. You could do, we just talked about Pier Street. You could, maybe there's a private real estate you want to do, or other things that yield 6 to 7%, which is higher than the 5.5% expected return for stocks. But there is no magic formula here or timing. Selling a taxable asset to reduce volatility will incur a tax hit. But again, you need to weigh that cost of that versus the potential higher cost of a major drawdown in stocks. So that is Plus episode 169. Have a great weekend.